Okay, can you hear me okay? I am much more used to attuning to a much smaller group and room, so if I'm messing up and not doing it right, then just wave and I shall try to make myself heard. I would like to begin by saying what an enormous privilege it is to be here today, and to acknowledge a debt of gratitude to various colleagues who have supported and informed the ideas in this paper, but most importantly, to the families that I've worked with who taught me a lot more than I taught them. I also wish to acknowledge the emotive and polarized nature of discussions about psychosis and how we all speak from deeply personal experiences and from positions of our own subjectivity. I also acknowledge that today it will only be possible to scratch a surface of a surface due to time constraints, and I'm going to be very rigorous and sticking to time boundaries. The fact that this event was massively oversubscribed is perhaps a sign that people are discontented with the current treatment of the mentally ill and are wondering whether psychoanalysis and attachment theory in particular has something better to offer. So I'll take you on a journey. R.D. Lang, the controversial and charismatic pioneer of the so-called anti-psychiatry movement that we heard about earlier, tells us, quote, "Research into the origins of schizophrenia requires that we begin at the beginning, that we put all presuppositions in brackets, and consider what is that whole long expanding spiral of multiple intensifying disjunctions and reciprocally widening alienation." End quote. In attempting to situate attachment theory understanding of psychosis within its historical context, including treatment in the asylum, it would be tempting to grasp for superficial and potentially unhelpful stereotypes, and there are inherent dangers in doing so. The historian Barbara Taylor argues of the historic context of the treatment of the mental illness, quote, "Bin memoirs are particular genres. Some are modern gothics, lurid tales of decent, healthy-minded people consigned to asylums by evil or stupid doctors. Others recount sufferings of individuals who, whilst they were certainly unwell at the point at which they were hospitalised, experienced asylum life as cruel and degrading. And a minority were very positive, depicting the asylum as a place of healing, a sanctuary from the madness of normal life. The portrayals are often black or white, mimicking the emotional extremes of the mental illness." End quote. The word asylum, as well as meaning a hospital for the mentally ill, comes from the noun protection and means protection or safety, especially that given by a government to people who have been forced to leave their own country for their safety or because of war. The language of attachment theory, ideas about the need for a safe haven, secure base, separation distress, and proximity seeking appears to have resonance with the historical context of the asylum, yet these links so far have not been made explicit. Language and narrative coherence also have a link with attachment theory and the historic treatment of the mentally ill. Frequently within institutions, and history has some fascinating examples of language and narrative as part of understanding mental illness. The image of the slide that you can see is of the jacket of Agnes Richter, an inmate from a Victorian German asylum. The marks on the jackets that you can see are words or sentences Agnes embroidered on her jacket as an attempt to understand her experience. Similarly, literary accounts or depictions of mental illness, such as the poem by Emily Dickinson, reveals a nuanced understanding of the social context of psychosis. And the poem goes like this. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense is darkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this as all prevails. Assent and you are sane. Demur, you're straightway dangerous and handled with a chain. There is a cause for concern about the current context of the treatment of mental illness. The Health and Social Care Information Centre report that between 2014 and 2015, there was a 9.8% increase in admissions under the Mental Health Act. New NHS figures obtained by Liberal Democrat MP Norman Lamb show that the number of serious untoward incidents involving mental health patients in England has risen by 21% over the last 3 years. That was cited by Campbell in The Guardian on the 26th of the 1st this year. Figures from the NHS Health and Social Care Information Centre, obtained through parliamentary questions, showed that the number of qualified nurses working in psychiatry dropped by 10.8%. Haroon Siddique and James Meikle reported in The Guardian on the 1st of Feb 2015. An investigation by Community Care magazine and the BBC last year found that more than 2,100 mental health beds have closed since April 2011. Amounting to a 12% decline in the total number available. It also found that 7 people had killed themselves since 2012, having been told there were no hospital beds for them. So clearly there is something deeply worrying about the current state of mental health services in the UK. And these figures reveal a profound breakdown in trust and represent genuine cause for concern. Camplin and Ballot argue, quote, "We are concerned that so little attention has been given to the understanding and promoting of what we see as central to the NHS enterprise as a whole, its embodiment in kinship, and its expression in the compassionate relationship between the skilled clinician and the patient. To have failed to attend to the promotion of kinship, connectedness, and kindness between staff and patients is to fail to address a key dimension of what makes people do well for others." End quote. Those who work in public services also reflect and are subjected to the whims of society. Peter Fonagy argues, quote, "I believe that disorganized attachment and associated complications in self-organisation can occur, at least in part, because society has relinquished its caretaking function, demolished its institutions for supporting emotional development, and shifted its priorities from the mental and emotional to the material. In the increasing violence around us, we may be seeing the casualties of this cavalier approach." End quote. So what about the future? I'm painting a rather apocalyptic view here. One of the trends noted has been the trend towards towards treatment in people's homes. The rhetoric appears to be that hospitals are not homes, meaning that people should not expect to stay in hospital for prolonged periods of time. Yet, we may wonder whether the policy of home treatment may have meant that homes have indeed become hospitals. Some authors have argued that this has had a gendered impact. Again, the historian Barbara Taylor argues, quote, "When politicians talk about community care, what they really mean is women. women inside and outside families, women struggling often with meagre resources to look after loved ones who are too crazy or too old or physically incapacitated to look after themselves. End quote. The intergenerational impact of these policies will only be known decades down the line. And you can be forgiven for feeling really quite depressed right now. But recently, there's been an increase in understanding of how attachment theory can inform the understanding of psychosis. Reed, Mosher, and Bentel argue, quote, "The question is, how can attachment theory help explain the relationship between childhood adversity and psychosis? At this stage, there are clearly more questions than answers, but the fact that these questions are being asked and addressed by researchers is a major step out of the darkness of the preceding several decades where such questions were virtually taboo." End quote. Schwartz argues that attachment theory is the only feasible theory of schizophrenia that we have. So it's not a particularly modest statement, but stay with it. Bowlby himself was incredibly modest about his views about attachment theory could be applied to the understanding of psychosis. And Carr reveals that Bowlby once said, "Attachment theory has nothing to contribute to the understanding of psychosis." I will argue that this turns out not to be the case. And subsequent generations of attachment theorists are in the throes of making the links between disorganized attachments and psychosis. Carr goes on to state, quote, "In a career that spanned over six decades, Bowlby succeeded in demonstrating beyond all doubt that mental health, our greatest prize, derives from consistent, reliable, and tender attachment relationships between infants and their caregivers. And that mental illness, our greatest tragedy, stems not necessarily from our genetic, biochemical, or neurophysiological endowment, but rather from parental attacks, abandonment, and impingement." End quote. The themes of this conference are history, politics, theory, and technique. In terms of the attachment theory, these are irrevocably linked. Attachment theory was developed in the aftermath of the Second World War and in the atmosphere of post-war recuperation and reparation. Attachment theory's message, put in its simplest form, is that we matter to each other, and that there should be a stress on real-life events rather than necessarily on fantasy, is inherently political and has profound social policy implications. It is also important to acknowledge that attachment theory is inherently different and perhaps at odds with other forms of psychoanalysis, such as a Kleinian approach, which would stress the intra-psychic and fantasy elements of psychosis as being of primary importance over actual real-life events and adverse experiences. Similarly, situating the understanding of psychosis within its relational context requires also that we adopt a relational approach to the treatment of psychosis and focus on the inter-psychic as well as the intra-psychic. Disorganized attachment is sometimes described as fear without solution, a situation where the child cannot form a consistent way of coping with a frightened or frightening caregiver, and so dissociates and becomes dysregulated. In order to understand how psychosis relates to disorganized attachment, it is important to have a clear working definition of what psychosis actually is. But some authors have argued that this is problematic. Drawing from trauma research, Andrew Moskovich argues, quote, "Our current definition of psychosis, shorthand for saying, I don't understand what this person is saying or doing, is problematic, as many, if not most, of these experiences may relate to life experiences, but the connection, for various reasons, may not always be obvious. Delusions, thought disorders, and bizarre behavior, catatonia, may be trauma-related, but the relationship is often obscured because of memory difficulties or mentalization deficits," end quote. Balbi himself stated that, quote, "Children not infrequently observe scenes that parents would prefer they did not observe. They form impressions that parents would like to believe that they did not form, and have experiences parents would like to believe that they had not had. Evidence shows that many of these children, aware of how their parents feel, proceed to then conform to their parents' wishes by excluding from further processing such information as they already have, and that, having done so, they seek consciously to be aware that they ever observed such scenes or formed such impressions or had such experiences. Here, I believe, is a source of cognitive disturbance as common as it is neglected," end quote. One of the markers that attachment researchers would look at in terms of evidence of disorganized attachment in adult attachment interviews are difficulties in constructing a coherent narrative, something that arguably lies at the heart of psychotic symptoms and distress. Research by Tyrrell and Dozier found that 89% of a sample with a diagnosis of schizophrenia were classified as dismissing of attachment when a three-category system, this is to say, secure, preoccupied, or dismissing, was used, and when the category unresolved in relation to loss or trauma, which is a key feature of disorganized states of mind, was added, 44% of the sample were categorized as unresolved. However, Dozier and colleagues urge for caution in making inferences from such research. The difficulty appears to be that the problem with interpreting these results is that disorganized attachment looks like psychosis, and psychosis looks like disorganized attachment. Could it be that disorganized attachment and psychosis appear in many ways to be similar because they are so intimately linked? Attachment theory informed clinicians have developed theories about the circumstances that have led to an individual developing psychosis. For example, Brett Carr has identified factors that are argued to be significant in what he describes as infanticidal attachment and its links to psychosis. And these are, quote, "actual parental death threats, in which a parent, through deeds or words, either attempts to kill a child, albeit unsuccessfully, or threatens to do so. The replacement child syndrome, in which the pre-schizophrenic child enters the world in the immediate aftermath of the death of an elder sibling, and then the replacement child ultimately realizes that he can never satisfy the grieving, bereaved relative parents and becomes mad in the process. Or aborted abortions, where a parent, usually a mother, informs her child directly that she had planned to abort the fetus during pregnancy, but for some unpreventable external reason, the termination cannot be carried out." There is some supporting evidence in which attachment theory and attachment-based research sets. I don't want to subject you to death by PowerPoint, so I'll be brief with this. There is research by Reed et al. Who have done multiple meta-analysis research that shows increased instances of abuse and adverse childhood experiences in patients with psychosis. There are adoption studies, which were mentioned earlier. There are neurological studies from orphanages which identify how the environment impacts on the neurodevelopment of children. There's higher prevalence of psychosis in children found born of mothers who suffer bereavement during pregnancy, by Kashan et al. And higher prevalence of psychosis in survivors of Holocaust and subsequent generations. Richard Bentall argues, quote, "How did the biomedical model become so dominant in psychiatry, and why has it persisted? What are the assumptions behind this approach, and are they supported by scientific evidence? Do the research findings collected with such dazzling technologies as functional magnetic resonance imaging and the methods of molecular genetics really support the idea that mental illness is a genetically influenced disorder of the brain? And what of the evidence of the effectiveness of psychiatric drugs? When answering these questions, we shall see that vested interests have often played a greater role in maintaining the biomedical approach than rational argument, than that the objections made by patients to cold and ineffective treatments have more often been ignored than heeded, and that there has been a proliferation of systematic misinformation about the effects of some of the most widely used psychiatric treatments," end quote. Balbi argued, quote, "Without a reasonably valid theory of etiology, systematic and agreed measures of prevention will never be supported. My hope that in the long term the greatest value of the theory proposed may prove to be the light it throws on the conditions most likely to promote healthy personality development. Only when those conditions are clear beyond all doubt will parents know what is best for their children and will communities be willing to help them provide it," end quote. Frequently, using the analogy of physical health and mental health is not helpful. However, in every field of human distress or medicine, it is imperative to have a valid theory of etiology. In order to treat or cure an outbreak of typhoid, for example, one of many, many conditions that I could have picked, we need to understand that the symptoms of typhoid are caused by the bacteria, and that in order to prevent the spread in the general population, it is imperative to locate the source of the infection and to treat to kill the bacteria. In the same way, with psychosis, it is imperative to have a valid theory of etiology in order to successfully treat the condition. Yet discovering painful truths about psychosis can be enormously emotive, and we might be left feeling very similar to those who discover the source of the contamination or the legendary Typhoid Mary. It also is important to understand how the traumatic events and disrupted attachments lead to the symptoms of psychosis rather than the other way around. As Balbi argues, quote, "Thus, whereas almost all present-day psychoanalytic theory starts with a clinical symptom, for example, stealing or depression or schizophrenia, and hypothesizes about events and processes that are thought to have contributed to its development, the perspective adopted here starts with the class of event, i.e. loss of mother figure in infancy or early childhood, and attempts hence to trace the psychological and psychopathological processes that commonly result. It starts with the traumatic event and works prospectively," end quote. I do just want to draw your attention to the significance of real-life events and trauma, but as I've just said, I don't want to subject you to death by PowerPoint. There is some research from the organisation Standing Together Against Domestic Violence that shows that between 50 and 60% of women mental health service users have experienced domestic violence, and up to 20% will be experiencing current abuse. 70% of women psychiatric inpatients and 80% of those in secure settings have histories of physical abuse or sexual abuse. Domestic violence commonly results in self-harm and attempted suicide. One-third of women attending emergency departments for self-harm were domestic violence survivors. Abused women are 5 times more likely to attempt suicide, and one-third of all female suicide attempts can be attributed to current or past experience of domestic violence. Now, any theory will have its detractors and those who take a strong stance against. Criticism of attachment theory's understanding of psychosis must be responded to. Schwartz argues, quote, attachment theory is not wanted because it challenges basic assumptions of Western patriarchal values that human emotional life is unimportant, that women's labor in doing emotional work does not count, and that rationality, thought without emotion, as if that were possible, is essential to effective functioning in the world. Instead, attachment theory asserts, amongst other things, the basic truth that human beings matter to each other, that without human relationships we become autistic, divorced from the realities of space and time, and that failures in attachment can cause damage to the developing brain of the human being instead of the other way round. End quote. Barbara Taylor also points to the emotional difficulties some have with accepting the value of attachment theory's understanding of psychosis and states, quote, listening to people, taking their words seriously brings them too close. Thinking about the meaning of someone's symptoms instead of just trying to dose the symptoms away with feelings of recognition and empathy. Much of Western psychiatry is designed to avoid such feeling. Drugging people on an industrial scale is the apotheosis of this avoidance strategy. One of the biggest problems with the meds, as one former mental health manager puts it, is that they blunt the effect of doctors, allowing them to imagine themselves as dispassionate brain fixers instead of what they really are, fellow human beings with all their own anxieties and vulnerabilities caught up in complex, highly charged relationships with their patients. And why practitioners would cling to such fantasy of professional detachment is no mystery. Madness touches us all in hidden places, and the urge to push it away can be hard to resist. Now it seems that most of the mental health system is yielding to this urge. End quote. Balbi is reported to have argued that the problem with burying grief is that so much else gets buried with it. In terms of our understanding of psychosis, it is important to note that unresolved grief and loss can be central in its importance in relation to psychosis. Trauma researchers such as Herman showed that those who've been traumatized tend to limit their lives by means as to prevent further exposure to traumatic triggers. And it is within this context that we can understand some of the symptoms of psychosis. We must also situate our understanding of psychosis not only within culture, society, history, economics, and political power, including its imbalance, but also within the context of the family and the interpsychic. As R.D. Lang puts it, the shadow of the family darkens one's vision. Until one can see the family within oneself, one can see neither oneself nor any family clearly. And top marks for anyone who can suggest whose family this is. Attachment theory locates its understanding of the etiology of psychosis within the understanding of disorganized attachment and including infanticidal attachment, and proposes an inherently relational cure or technique for a relational ill. I shall end with a quote from Corriveau and Dallara commenting on Balbi's ghost, and they write, quote, "The intellectual and explanatory power found in Balbi's trilogy transformed how we think about human identity, psychopathology, and relationships. He tells us that there is no real escape from not loving our children. He tells us that parenting techniques are not substitutes for fuller presence of the heart. He tells psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists that they are in the serious business, where even their best efforts may not compensate for the deep, enduring wounds of childhood. He tells us, finally, that we cannot escape the fragile stewardship of our humanity, a humanity that can only flow onwards through time in the delicate and tender gaze and touch of those that love us and that we love. And that is very scary indeed." Thank you. Thank you.